the USDA's AC21 Agricultural Biotechnology Advisory Committee. I want to thank our listeners for joining us and remind everyone that Food Sleuth Radio is produced by Dan Hemmelgarn at KOPN Studios in beautiful downtown Columbia, Missouri. Thank you again, Dr. Benbrook.
Thank you.
Up next is Madness Radio.
Mommy? Daddy?
You know you love KBOO's programming, but did you know you can help inform decisions about new programs on KBOO, support evaluating shows to ensure programming excellence, as well as help process feedback about shows from our listeners? Well, you can when you join the KBOO Programming Advisory Committee. All you need to be is a KBOO member. Attend monthly meetings on the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. at KBOO, and commit 5 hours a month to work on committee-related tasks. The Programming Advisory Committee works alongside KBOO programming staff to live out our programming charter. You can find out more at kboo.fm/committees. See you the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. KBOO needs you.
The time is 11:31. Madness Radio up next.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Bhargavi Davar. Bhargavi is a childhood survivor of mental institutions. She's a philosopher and psychologist and founder and director of Bapu Trust, a mental health and disability agency in Pune, India, and working throughout Asia. She's also a coordinator of INTAR, the International Network Towards Alternatives and Recovery. So welcome to Madness Radio, Bhargavi Davar.
Hi, Will, and hi, everyone.
It's very interesting to have you on the show because we know that the pharmaceutical industry and the medical model and the diagnostic and statistical manual is a global phenomenon, and there's an effort to kind of so-called modernize and really westernize other cultures. And so we're going to be talking about the situation with mental health in India and really trying to get beyond a lot of the stereotypes and the misconceptions. We tend to have a view that's either very, very negative or very, very romanticized of what is happening in Asia and India. So we're going to be talking about that. But maybe we could just begin by hearing about how you yourself got connected to and involved in the mental health system and then how you went on to become a psychologist and to work as an advocate for change.
I spent a lot of time during my childhood years, when I was about 5 or 6 years old, roaming the old mental asylums. India, for a long time, and even now, we continue to have the old colonial type warehousing kind of institutions, you know, with the large acres of land, large buildings with bare rooms, lockup wards, solitary confinement, the old ECT machine. We still have many of them. So my mother used to be in lockup and when I was about 5 or 6. And that's the mystery that I've tried to kind of solve through the years, you know. Was she mad or was she spiritual? Was she in search of God? Was she bad? Was she a bad woman? I know her when very, very small, you know, as a loving mom. I have a brother too, and both of us were very attached to her. she was a, you know, she was very much in prayer for most of the time. She was very creative. She could write poetry, mostly devoted to God, some of the Hindu gods that she was very fond of. And she could decorate the house and, you know, the God's room and everything for hours, and also dress herself up in ways which are considered as sacred, you know, wearing certain type of clothes, not wearing certain other types of clothes, and so on and so forth. So, and sooner or later, people started seeing this as a kind of obsession. She also then started to hear voices. She could speak to gods and goddesses. But she was, as far as I know, she wrote very coherent verses, which were revered by the spiritualists in and around my household.
She wrote verses. She wrote poetry.
She was a good Sanskrit scholar. She had learned Sanskrit, and she could write poetry in Sanskrit. But over a period of time, those actions by her were just seen as some kind of madness, because it definitely took away the time that she had to give to managing the household and a very large family of brothers and sisters, their sons and daughters, and so on. We had what is called a joint family, a traditional Tamil Brahmin joint family. So she was expected, being the eldest daughter-in-law, she was expected to kind of be of service to the family. And she didn't have much time for that. So,
because she was so interested in her spiritual pursuits, which were quite serious and quite scholarly, it sounds like.
Yeah. And she was also an artist. She could draw and paint. She was a great cook. Anyway, I think so. At some point, my family started seeing all of this as some kind of madness. And then the traditional healers came in, and then the psychiatric doctors came in, and then she was rounded up and literally tied up and taken to the local mental hospital. My childhood memories are of her being chained, you know, with iron chains, spread eagled and iron chained in those old bare, cold, solitary confinement wards. And my memories from childhood are of her being given shock treatment. And if you hang around with someone, you know, with your mom, who is a voice hearing person at the age of 4 or 5, you also end up hearing voices, you know. It's like you could see her ghosts, and you could see her gods, and you could see the devil, you know, doing a dance around your house every night wearing red clothes, and you can see spirits walking down the stairs every night, you know. So my childhood and my brother's childhood were filled with really, really strange events.
So it sounds like your mom was in conflict with other family members, and they expected her to play the role of the household wife and the mother, and to be doing the domestic work. And yet she was very interested in her spiritual beliefs and her spiritual path. Do you think it would have been different if she was a man?
Yes, I think so, you know, because men, it's okay for the men to be in prayer. In fact, it's prayer is an area which is dominated by masculinity in Indian traditional households, you know. Maybe there would have been some stigma if the man was in prayer and not earning any money, you know. They are called the renouncers, and they are also stigmatized. Men who renounce and don't get employed and bring money home, they are equally stigmatized in traditional families.
Would the male renouncers also risk ending up in psychiatric hospitals?
Maybe not, you know, because their escape route is fairly easy compared to the women. Women find it difficult to escape. And this is something we've found in the communities where we work, the low-income communities as well. The men, you know, the men who want to live a life of difference and deviance, they have greater freedoms to wander away. Whereas for the women, it's house arrest, never leave home, or, you know, end up in a local institution. Necessarily just the mental hospital, but there are also the beggars' homes, there are the women's shelters. So India is full of these old colonial structures.
When she was taken to traditional healers and then to psychiatry, were there other people in the family who were defending her? Was there anybody who was really standing up for her right to be a renouncer?
Not at all, you know. I'm really sad. This is the saddest part of my life. And I think this sadness, which has really put me into my line of work. It's a sadness, the guilt of not having seen any help coming to her, not being able to help her. You know, I was too tiny, 5 years and 6 years. My rational mind tells me that, look, you know, it was not your fault. But the deepest part of me is very sad that there was no one to help her. And so I've seen lots of atrocities committed on her. You know, she would run away from the mental institution. Then they would set the police after her. The police would literally tie her up, you know, in ropes and bring her home. And then she would be shunted off to the mental hospital. So these are old memories, and these are really, really hard to forget. I think that's what has stayed with me after all these years. And I've tried my hand at having my own personal life, you know, getting married, having boyfriends, trying to go to parties, but none of those things ever stayed with me for very long. It's just those memories which get triggered off every now and then. And I'm having to just pursue the path of working for change. I think there was a deep connection between me and my mom when she was in prayer. I was about 4 or 5, maybe, when she was in deep prayer. She would wake up really early in the morning, say about 4 o'clock. And then she would spend a lot of time, you know, decorating the gods in her god room. And I remember one morning, there was this particular picture that she had brought home the previous night, of a male god, and she was like very secretive about it. And then she said, no, you can't see it, it's too late tonight, so I'm going to show it to you tomorrow morning. I'll have everything decorated and then you can see him. And I said okay, and then I went off to sleep. And then at 4 o'clock I had this really brilliant vision of this god in full splendor, you know, and fully decorated with all the kinds of flowers that I hadn't seen, actually. The whole god's room was decorated, and there was this particular picture, very resplendent and very brilliant, you know, lit up and everything. So then I woke up, and my mom had not even entered the god's room at this time. It was about 4 in the morning, and she has just had a bath. And I described to her in complete detail what the picture was and how the picture was decorated. And she was shocked. And she said, you couldn't have known this because you've not seen this yet. She had, of course, a very spiritual explanation why God came to me. And she was full of apologies for not having shown me the God's picture the previous night. That's how I remember my mom and our life with her. My brother had even more strange experiences. And both of us do, over a period of time, you know, carry these experiences of something strange and uncanny happening to us every now and then. So she went and lived in a temple for many years, so by herself. And when we finally went to meet her, like 10 years after she left our home.
So she had gotten out of the mental hospitals and ended up living in a spiritual temple.
She lived in a temple for many years. And when finally we kind of both had grown into full adults, and about 20, 21, we told our dad that we want her back. And so we searched her out in an old temple somewhere in south of India. We found her in a really small, shabby room, you know, and I'll not forget, this is another of those memories, and it's one of those things that left a lingering doubt in me, which has pursued me all my life, is, you know, was she really crazy, you know, because when we entered the room, the entire wall of that room was filled with her incoherent writings. She was incoherent. She wasn't wearing much clothes on her, and she was not there, you know. Her soul was not there.
So you found your mother in this temple in southern India, and she was in this very shabby room. That must have been remarkable to see her after 10 years.
Yeah. And then they started her on psychiatric medication again. And truth to tell, she did improve with those medicines. But by this time, she was completely disabled, you know, waist down. She had completely lost all motor functions. She didn't live very long after this. She passed on just after my dad. Both of them died pretty young.
So you say she did improve with the medications. What sort of improvement did you see?
Well, we could hold a conversation with her. She still continued to talk to gods. She became a local healer, by the way.
And was she helping to heal people in the local community there?
Yeah, she was for quite a few years. She was considered the local healer and a goddess, and manifestation of a goddess. So
Do you feel it was the medications that helped her to kind of be in that role and be able to carry conversations?
Yeah, I think so, that the medication she was on at the time helped her to hold coherent conversations. But I also think it was the love that was available to her in the household.
The love that was available.
Yeah, yeah. My brother and his wife took good care of her, you know. So she had Parkinson's and all the tardive dyskinesia and all the symptoms, and she died pretty young. But I think so for 3-4 years, it gave her somewhat of a good quality of life that she may not have experienced before.
Did you yourself start to struggle with difficult emotional states or get into conflicts or get drawn into strong spiritual practice like your mother?
Well, through most of my younger years, I was an atheist. I hated gods. But I was pretty much a withdrawn child, very much introverted. And my traumas came up as very, very strong nightmares, strange experiences. I lived a life of loneliness without friendships, without being able to speak. I had a major stutter and a stammer. I was invisible. And I had an acute crisis when I was about 34, 35. And it took me 4 years to get out of that. It was really, really bad. I had nightmares, and I had days and days of crying, anger, breaking things. Suicidal attempts. And so there was something around me which was keeping me alive, for which I was very grateful later on. But I certainly was drawing from whatever it was that was there around me. There weren't people. If there were people around me, they would have put me inside. So those were really, really bad times. My friend, who's a clinical psychologist, said that I probably need medicines. And then I said, I'm not going to have medicines. And I'm going to try this my own way. One of the things that really caused the depression was a deep spiritual crisis for which I found an answer, you know. I lost my daughter, and that's what tripped me off. My daughter was born terribly, terribly sick. And she had complicated medical conditions which was not even diagnosable. I was by her side 24/7 until she died in my arms. Of course, after that, I went completely crazy. I mean, I was completely not there for 4 years. And that was the spiritual experience. That's what brought me back to my own spiritual existence. When I started thinking about life and death in a very different way, you know, life was not given to me by me. Life is precious. Life is always short. And so what life we have is really what we make of it. So that came to me, and I made several resolutions about making the best of the time that I had with me. And this came to me, you know, when I was about 40 or so. I went into lots and lots of healing activities. I made a resolve to be of use to the universe. So that's when spirituality started coming to me.
And when did you start to become a mental health advocate and founder of the Bapu Trust?
I lost my daughter in 1994. And so 5 years later, Bapu Trust was born. Bapu's the name, in fact, of my mother. It's in dedication to my mother and her life, which for me is iconic. For India and for Asia.
How do you mean that? It's iconic for India and Asia.
A lot of women go through what she did. And so every day we get calls. Even yesterday we had a Skype call. Someone who was deviant in some way or the other. She's getting psychiatrized, getting pushed into a mental hospital. Husband is filing for divorce, not giving her alimony, taking away the kids. It's iconic. It's till today. And we are a post-colonial state. And so we have lots and lots of these laws. Where if you're a deviant woman, then to put you away in an institution and file for divorce is, you know, is really, really easy.
So the husbands will use the divorce as a way of just casting the woman aside, and then she has no resources, she has no support. And you see these stories all the time.
Yeah, sometimes when we have the resources and when the women are close by, we go and help them out with legal assistance or other kinds of advocacy. We've run campaigns to get women out of institutions. I related to having deep-seated trauma of having been colonized over 200 years. That's why Asia, working in Asia, has been so liberating for me. You know, you will not find institutions in the way you'd find them in India and other Commonwealth countries.
Countries that were not colonized in the same way.
Yeah,
as
countries
India.
Were not colonized. That's true of Africa, Latin America. About half the world was not, you know, they don't have these institutions or these laws. And it's the whole thing of being a victim of any kind of oppression. So some of us in India who are activists have to struggle with this victimhood of long-term trauma. Whereas in large parts of the world, particularly in Asia, like Nepal and Indonesia, some of these other countries, they don't have that that history, nor do they feel so frustrated, angry, bitter, disappointed, and hopeless, you know, because those systems are not there, those laws are not there. You can start from scratch building communities. That's where I see my hope and the hope of the Bapu Trust, in actually being in spaces where you really don't have to be a trauma victim, you know, either personally or in your work life. You know, you don't have to keep repeating the story of trauma over and over again.
Help us understand that a little bit more. So you're saying that in India, with the legacy of colonialism and these huge institutions and this legal apparatus, it creates a very specific circumstance of victimization and victimhood, whereas in other parts of Asia, you don't see that. And so you're more hopeful. Tell us some examples of that. Help us understand that a little bit more.
Nepal, for example, you know, Nepal is a clean slate. Nepal was never colonized. They don't have institutions. They have one hospital, which looks like any other hospital. It doesn't look like those big colonial type warehousing institutions where there are thousands and thousands of people naked, you know, behind bars. You don't find those things. I can say that that system is very different from the mental institutions. In some places, you will find that people are tied up, you know, but people are tied up in public, not inside some dingy, dank, closed wards where nobody ever goes and many people are dying in there. These are tied up right in front. And usually whenever a person is tied up, the family is right around them, feeding them. The children are playing in the grounds, you know, they're all open out there for you to see. So it's very difficult to commit heinous violence. Yeah, so there are community justice systems at work over here. But whereas in a mental institution, first of all, it's a legal power. It's the power of the state. Whereas this is the power of communities. And the state comes in with all its machinery. It's got the security guards. It's got the ECT machines, the physical prison-like environment, and all of that. And it's got even, we've heard so much about people being beaten up, people dying, and the pictures all the time, you know, get posted every now and then. So the kind of power we are talking about with respect to mental institutions in comparison to what happens in communities, these are two different levels of coercion.
So in the communities, is there more of a tolerance for deviant behavior? Is there more space for someone to become a renouncer or become very dedicated to their spirituality and to drop out of those ordinary roles of the household and business and working life?
I think so in urban areas. We work in the slums. We've been working in the slums for the last 10 years. These are low-income communities, open housing, you know, people move in and out of their households. And there are good support systems because everybody is poor, so you've got to depend on each other to cover for acute poverty or acute hunger and starvation. So people are really out there, you know, and if you interact with these people, you do find that there is a lot of tolerance. Though I would not say that there is no stigma, especially if you're a man and there's a and you're like, you know, you've got like three kids and you've gone crazy and you're not able to work and all you want to do every day is wander. So then you're going to get into trouble with your wife and your mother. So there are those negotiations which happen, but people usually, you know, they stand up for each other. They're not thinking of, okay, let's put him in the mental hospital. That's not the first thing that will come to them. Whereas, yeah, I mean, the mental hospital system, if you're middle class, you'll find that people are looking at mental hospital and psychiatry far quicker.
What about the traditional treatments and the traditional cures and healing? Is that helping people in these temple contexts and these community contexts to move forward and to get more of a grip on their lives? Is it helping them to recover in a sense?
Like I said, you know, I spent a lot of my life as an atheist, and what really holds me to my life and brings hope is spiritual pursuit. And we've seen that reflected in many of the interviews that we did in the Sufi dargahs, the churches, and the temples. You know, if you go out with an objective indicator, and there have been studies where people have gone out with objective indicators and found some elements of recovery, even in people with so-called psychosis. In terms of self-experience and self-report of what they go through, many, many people report feeling refreshed and feeling better, you know, after going through these spaces. And I'm an arts-based therapist, and wherever we've gone, we've seen some expression of creativity in these places. Seen lots and lots of drumming, shamanic drumming, rhythmic movement, body movements, muttering, you know, chanting, prayers, loud wailing, using the body to heal. Women who would hesitate to even take off their head cover within their households, you can see them literally shedding clothes and somersaulting. There's such body freedom. It cannot but have a good mental, physiological effect. And I say that as someone who's continues to do heavy physical labor, you know, in order to feel good.
What is your vision of bringing together the best in traditional cultures with some of the more modern psychologies and modern approaches as a way to get away from the colonial legacy and the psychiatric perspective?
We believe that if we use words and language and logic and reason, the possibility of conflict is very high. So we can spend many hours, you know, talking about the mental institutions and what's going on over there, and there could be different opinions and all of that. So this is one way. The other way is to be silent, cultivate the art of silence, and allow the body to respond with its different sensory capacities, and allow the body to quieten down, calm down, and heal itself. And if visions of God or visions of demons help us in our path of recovery, then that's all very fine. And so we use a lot of drumming and chanting, different kinds of breathing, involuntary movements, art and creativity, song making. So some of these we have derived actually from traditional healing systems. Buddhism has played a huge part in our growth, in the growth of our programs, particularly Buddhist emphasis on the impermanence of emotions, you know, and our mental lives. The fact that it's like a river, never once the same for a moment, you know. And so some of these principles have helped us to kind of have a more dynamic view about ourselves as people very much capable of rejuvenating and recovering ourselves in the moment. We do have a community mental health program which kind of applies some of the principles that I just spoke about. Peace building, how to reduce conflict, how to be calm, how to build body discipline so that you're not, you know, jumping out of your body at the moment, you know, you're triggered by something or the other. How to hold your communications to a point where you're saying just what is objective and not what is emotional. How do you kind of have an everyday practice that will increase your stamina and endurance, and improve your fitness, your lung capacity, you know, the amount of oxygen you take into your body? How do you change your diet? So these are everyday practices. So I call it peace of mind on the go. And I think this can be taught. It's a practice. It's a skill. It's there's nothing spiritual about it, though it can lead to really strange experiences and you can feel like you're really connected with God. But a lot of it is body practice. And I think those can be taught in simple ways.
And does this fit with the traditional cultures? Is this something that really builds on what's there already in the communities?
Yeah, yeah. If you're across Asia, you have, you know, Tai Chi, Qigong, yoga. You have all kinds of practices which are very useful, and they humanize cities. In Pune, for example, we are a small city, but Bapu Trust is one of them, which works in low-income communities. But around the city, there are a number of these, what so to speak, quiet rooms. You know, you go in there and you just be for a bit. You watch your impulses, you watch the anger coming up, you know, you figure out who you hate and you just watch that and let that emotion go.
Bhargavi, we are just about out of time. Give people the contact information that they can get in touch with you and they can find out more about your work and more about the work of the Bapu Trust.
Yeah, we're at www.baputrust.com. It's BAPUTRUST.com. And another way to reach me is at my personal email ID, which is bvdarvar@gmail.com.
Bhargavi Darvar, thank you so much for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thanks a lot, Will.
You've been listening to an interview with Bhargavi Darvar, She's a childhood survivor of mental institutions, a philosopher, and a psychologist. She's the founder and the director of the Bapu Trust, a mental health and disability agency in Pune, India, and working throughout Asia, and also a co-coordinator of INTAR, the International Network Towards Alternatives and Recovery. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Madness Radio is sponsored by the Icarus Project and Portland Hearing Voices. Host is Will Hall and producer is Nina Packabush. Madness Radio can be heard on KBOO FM and the Pacifica Network, and shows are archived online at madnessradio.net.
The time is 11:59. Thank you for listening to KBOO Portland. Up next, the news at noon.
Sale. This is a great time to clean out those closets and shelves and turn your old books, records, and CDs into cash for community radio. Bring them to KBOO Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. We're accepting donations of books, vinyl records, CDs, and DVDs through Wednesday, August 10th. The sale will be held in mid-August. Stay tuned for details. Please, no home recorded cassettes, VHS tapes, or mold. If you have questions or want to arrange for a pickup of donations, please email Ani at volunteer@kbu.org or phone her at 503-231-8032, extension 213.
Now the KBOO News at noon for Monday, August 1st, 2016. In local news, a newly issued report shows Oregon incarcerates African Americans at a rate more than 40% over the national average and almost double that of Washington State. The report was issued by the Sentencing Project, a national